Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Live from the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Radio K's Culture Q, the Twin Cities Arts and Culture program providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matthew Curtis, and thank you for joining us. This week, we're talking technology. We've come a long way from Pong, dial-up internet, and computers that filled entire rooms. We now live in an age where we're hooked up whenever we see fit, and things are only getting smaller, faster, and more capable. But with all these advancements, certain responsibilities need to be taken, and risks need to be avoided. Aaron Bolton investigates a data breach, Marjorie Otto weighs the morality of pirating content, and Joe Crowell gives us advice in securely using the internet. And it all starts right now on Radio K's Culture Q. Over the past 20 years, computers have become a widely used part of daily life. They allow you to stay in touch, get work done, and information is always at your fingertips. But as we invite this technology into our lives, we also invite the issues that come with it. Cybersecurity being the biggest among them, we not only need to learn how we can prevent privacy issues, but to prepare ourselves when a break-in happens. Reporter Aaron Bolton has the story.
Tonight, new concern about a security breach, this time at Home Depot.
Target hit with a huge security breach.
The word security breach. It has become part of our vocabulary over the past few years in light of large-scale attacks on corporations. They are described as
alarming security breach,
massive security breach,
the largest cyber attacks in U.S. history.
And it could be bigger than the breach at Target.
They may make you nervous about your personal information, but it can be easy to forget about the variety of techniques hackers ploy to wage cyber warfare one person at a time. The person behind the other screen may not be stealing your identity, but instead wants you to pay them using
a fairly new thing that's occurring in our environment.
This is Brian DeLynn, Chief Information Officer at the University of Minnesota, and he's talking about computer hijacking.
You hear it called things like CryptoLocker and stuff. Basically, it's somebody has some piece of malware that encrypts the drive and makes it unreadable, unless you have the key.
The primary target of an attack like this isn't your personal information, it's your money.
A banner came across, and it was not a GUI interface. It was like the old machine language, I guess you'd call it. It just said that if you want these files to open up, you must pay $1,000, and it gave some instructions on how to transfer money to this place. My name is Raleigh Mattson. I'm a 61-year-old male who looks much older than that.
Mattson is a sales representative for a large computer distributor who works from home, and his work computer was hijacked a few months ago.
Did you lose all your files, or are your files stored on the cloud storage?
I didn't think it was necessary for me because I'm that clever. So I lost everything except for in my email things. There are things that the company backs up, but the personal files, they were just gone.
Mattson has seen just about every major change in the computer industry.
I have known since day one to back things up. I sell computers every day for 40 years. I tell people one thing, back up your stuff.
How someone like him can get put into a position like this, it's hard to pinpoint.
I said yes to somebody. I accepted something. I probably get in a day, business-related, specific to me, 200 emails. Mm-hmm. I'm copied on things, that kind of thing. If you catch 5,000 of your emails, no problem. But the 5,000 first is a problem, that's what it is.
Okay, so far you've heard terms like encrypt, virus, and malware. To make this straightforward, here's how it goes. The hacker attaches malicious software, known as malware, to link generally sent through email. So for someone like Mattson who gets 200 emails a day, it can be difficult to always have your guard up. The victim clicks on the link and the malware is installed onto the device. The malware then has the ability to lock up your hard drive, the piece of hardware that stores all your information on your computer.
If you spam a million people, some insignificant small part are going to send the money back, because it costs nothing to spam 100 people is no less than spamming 100 million people. It's a pretty ingenious thing to do, and most of it begins with a belief in Russia.
It can be easy to think of the person on the other side as this sophisticated hacker across the world, but Mattson's cyber attacker could have been his next door neighbor using malware purchased off the internet.
They're just using malware that's out there, that's available. They're not often creating it themselves. They're buying something.
And these pieces of software don't always do the same thing.
It all depends on the type of malware that they've put involved and the ones that you were describing earlier.
I had explained to him earlier what had happened in Madsen's case.
Generally the ones that they're completely locking the entire drive versus they may be locking some piece of information instead. But it all depends on the malware that they've used.
Because there's such a variety of malware used, it makes it even harder to understand how it happened to you. Some forms of malware give its user the ability to launch their attack at a time they choose. So if you clicked on the link 2 months ago, you may not even remember it.
It could be months, it could be a year, it could be, you know, a long time.
Once it's happened, there's not a whole lot you can do. And as for Madsen's computer?
I sent it back and it was destroyed. They won't take the risk of looking at the drive and that thing, they just destroyed it.
Dylan says the best thing you can do to fight computer hijacking is to back your stuff up to a place not connected to your computer.
I don't fear it. I mean, it's a fact of life. I mean, I guess you could worry about everything. Unless you go off the grid and turn your machine off, you're open to that.
As computers continue to creep into our lives, so do the issues they bring with them. It's Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it will. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
All right. In the studio, we have here Aaron Bolton, producer for Radio K and Culture Q. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. How are you, man?
I'm not too bad, man. How's the start of the semester been for you?
It's the start of the semester. Spring semester is always hard to get back into. Break just always kills my motivation.
I feel you, man. I feel you. But, you know, you got your story done.
Yeah.
Against all the odds. And how was that process?
It was pretty good. It actually came together better than I thought. Looking at computer hijacking, when going into it, I was figuring it was going to be this super complicated process, and it turned out to be quite a lot more simplistic than I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. So how did the story appear to you? Like, how did it kind of surface into your sights?
Initially, I was told by a friend that their father's work computer had been hijacked. And it had. And initially, it was described to me that it happened to the whole office. So in my head, I was picturing this like chaotic scene of like, you know, 40 employees going, oh, you know what's going on? Like everyone's computer went down, and I heard that they destroyed all the computers. Then all of a sudden, the real story came into view, which was it happened to 3 people out of 5,000. But it was still an interesting concept because it had happened to my own dad quite some time ago. So I had kind of seen the repercussions of this particular thing a couple times.
Well, why wasn't it company-wide? Do you know anything about that?
It's just because, only those 3 people had clicked on whatever link it was that infected their computers with it, mm-hmm. With the malware that, you know, was able to hijack their computer.
What was interesting about this to you?
The interesting thing is when everyone thinks of like security breach, it's always your identity that's at stake. It's always, in end game, it's always money that they're after, it seems like. But this is just another way to manipulate money out of people. But it's interesting because it gives the person that it happens to the choice. And then my biggest question, which obviously I can't get answered because I'm not talking to the person who's, you know, doing something like this, is if you paid the money, would they actually unlock your hard drive, or they just take the money and not think, you know, think about it again?
So if you were in the situation and, you know, your computer and all of your documents got hijacked and then some text appears on your computer that says, will you pay X amount of money to get your stuff back? Would you do it?
No, probably not. They're usually like saying like $1,000 up to like $2,000, and it's just no way. I wouldn't trust it, and that's a lot of money, especially for me being a college student anyways, to dump into something that's not even a guarantee. It's better just to suck it up, move on, and just hopefully be. It's just a fact of life now. That's basically the point of it. It's a fact of life. It if it can happen, it will happen, and so just. I don't know. I'm just better at backing up my stuff, I guess.
I mean, you mentioned backing up your stuff. What would you recommend to listeners to either avoid these things altogether or, you know, prevent too much damage being done to their intellectual property?
You know, that was a big question, is how can you prevent it? And I every time I asked that question, it basically got the same answer back, was that you can't. I can't say I can guarantee it'll happen to you, but there's a very good chance that something of this nature will happen. So the best choice is to just back up your stuff to an external hard drive. That way, if it happens to you, then that hacker's out of luck because you still have all your data.
Great. Well, that's pretty much all I have for you. Aaron, is there anything that you want to get across in the story?
Basically, just that with computers and how, I mean, obviously everyone knows that it's just becoming a bigger part of your life, but it now the issues they bring with them are becoming facts of life, and that's just pretty much how we're going to, you know, work our way through those things.
I guess we'll have to roll with it. All right, thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Matt.
There are a lot of ways to get music today. There's iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, physical copies. Another method, downloading without paying. And this is a popular method for cash-strapped college students. In this story, Marjorie Otto examines if there's an issue with the morality when it comes to how we source our tunes.
I've noticed recently that it seems as though everyone has their own way to get music, and a lot of people have strong opinions on how they get it, especially when it comes to paying versus not paying for music. It's kind of like everyone has their own moral code for it. So I was curious to see if there is some kind of morality to how we source our music.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Jeremy Fine. I am the Associate Rabbi at Temple of Aaron.
I asked him how he defined morality.
So I think morality has to do with how we not only treat people, I guess there's three levels, how we treat ourselves, how we treat the people around us, both our loved ones and our general friends and community, but also how we also view how our lives play into the general existence of the world. So what we do and decisions that might impact us positively, if they're affecting the world negatively, that also plays a role.
To really know what morality means, I spoke with someone whose job it is to think about morality on a daily basis.
For example, in Judaism, we have keeping kosher, right? And keeping kosher is a checking point for what are we putting into our body. It's not necessarily a better diet. It does, and a lot of people don't even do it because they feel it was ordained by God, but they do it as, I'm even going to check what goes into my system.
I found his kosher idea to be analogous with responsibly sourcing what goes into our ears.
My brain. My life is gone.
To find out how others get their music and how that impacts an artist, I spoke with avid music listeners and musicians Carl, Sylvan, Evan, and Zach, who have a band named Wicked Tamazusa.
Honestly, if I can't find it readily, I'm going to torrent that.
So me, I'm in a weird position where I'm using Pandora a lot.
I only buy vinyl and use CDs.
I pay $9.99 for Google Play.
And the general consensus of the group and the reasoning behind why they choose the methods that they choose? They all seem mostly concerned about getting money directly to the artist. Here's Sylvan.
When I download music for free, I feel like I'd rather just, instead of buying the album, which I kind of feel guilty about because, like, this money is going to the corporations, not all the people. I'd rather just download all the albums for free and then send a check to the band, just straight to the band, so they get the money because they're the ones who made the music.
And Zach.
I kind of view downloading music as kind of like a screen. Like, I download music and I find what I like, and if I like them, I'll go to your show and I'll pay to see your show and I'll give you money that way.
I also asked them as a band what their thoughts were on how people get their music and how it affects them.
I would be honored if someone felt the need to pirate it.
I mean, that could be, that would make my day. as an unknown, as a tiny group, you just want anybody and anybody to hear your music and go, hey, that's cool.
So have we reached a definitive answer about the morality of how we source our music? Not really. Not this time. But it's a start. For Culture Q, I'm Marjorie Otto.
Hello, you listen to Radio K's Culture Q still, and we're going to talk about the weekly release spotlight now with copywriter for Radio K, Sam Siegel.
Hey, Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you too. What are we talking about this week?
We're doing the Downer EP by local rapper Dem Atlas. It's out on Rhymesayers Entertainment. I'm not sure if the entertainment is actually still in the name, but RSE, Rhymesayers Entertainment, and their new EP, Downer by Dem Atlas.
Great. What track should we play?
Let's do the song What About. It's the opening track, and it really just announces things with an absolute bang.
Well, here it is, the banger of the Downer EP, What About, right here on Radio K's Culture Q. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt.
Once again, Walkabout by Dem Atlas from the newest Downer EP. You can check out Sam's full review and download a free track from the album on RadioK.org. Everything on the internet, from tiny online stores to big ticket gaming systems, demands some of our most personal, private information before we can access their services. Joe Crowell gives us advice on how to navigate the waters of information privacy in the digital age. This piece is taken all the way back from 2011, but a lot of it still holds true. If you own a Sony PlayStation 3, you have probably noticed that for a little over a week now, you've been unable to connect to the PlayStation Network. You're not the only one. Following attacks by hackers on April 17th and 19th, Sony formally shut down the network to investigate one of the largest security breaches in recent memory. While it now appears that no credit card information was obtained in the attack, Sony has admitted to coughing up personal information, including names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, birth dates, and passwords for its over 77 million user accounts. In light of such events, I sat down with Gareth McMaster, the manager of the Carlson School's IT Student Services Help Desk, to talk a little bit about data security and the internet age. So, Gareth, you know, looking at the results of this attack, do you think users were somewhat at fault for giving up so much data about themselves?
That's pretty difficult. I mean, in this day and age, you're going to have to hand over some private data in order to get services you want. That's sort of part of the Faustian bargain people have agreed to with the internet these days, especially when they use the internet to buy services from large companies such as Sony or Amazon.
Well, should we be able to expect those companies to protect our data then, or is that just sort of a implicit risk of the internet?
Whether you can expect them to protect your data, I can't even begin to answer that. They have certain liability when it comes to your data, and that's the only thing I see working for you in the equation, that they can end up on the wrong end of a large class action lawsuit. That doesn't necessarily help you when you've had your bank account raided by a hacker.
All right. Now, fair enough. So what are some of the things that maybe students can do to protect their data and to ensure their own security online?
Let's see. Not only use complex passwords, but use different passwords for different sites. If you use the same password on several important sites, having it compromised once by a piece of malware on your computer means now they have access to an array of information about you, from whether it's your password used for Facebook and then you use it on in your banking and your credit cards. Use complex passwords and use different passwords for different sites.
I heard you mention malware in there. How big of a deal is malware, and what can students do to try and protect themselves from viruses and stuff like that?
Updates for your operating system are crucial. These usually come out weekly or biweekly, especially if you're using Windows. There are three updates in particular that you need to keep an eye on. The first is obviously Windows itself. Windows updates are important to run as often as you can. The second is Java. Now, usually certain sites and applications require you to install Java, and it usually comes with its own updater, which will pop up intermittently. Always run Java updates. Third, Flash. Flash runs things like YouTube and various other sites like that, and a lot of other applications use Flash. Flash games. Everybody has Flash. Everybody has Java installed on their machine. Both of these applications/frameworks are crucial avenues for malware to infect your machine. If these two pieces of software are not up to date, you don't have to do anything wrong to acquire a piece of malware. You can merely go to a website.
What do you mean, go to a website? Like, go to a hacker's website, or what are you talking about?
A couple years ago, there were advertising networks that served up ads on sites such as Fox News or the New York Times. Merely visiting web pages that on those sites, because the advertising networks were infected, could infect your machine through no fault of your own. So while downloading an application that you're not sure of and running it is a common way of acquiring malware, merely visiting a website, accidentally or on purpose, without having done anything beyond that, is a method of acquiring malware, especially if you do not keep Flash and Java up to date.
Wow. Okay. Well, those are some pretty good tips. And I guess for more tips, students can go to http://privacy.ahc.umn.edu. For Culture Q, I'm Joe Kroll, and this is Gareth McMaster. You've been listening to Culture Q on Radio K, hearing every Sunday at 6 p.m. bringing you all the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you hear the voices of Aaron Bolton, Joe Krell, Marjorie Otto, Sam Siegel, and Matthew Curtis. Our producers are Aaron Bolton and Amy Friedman, our coach Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm your host and managing editor, Matthew Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. You can join us on Facebook, just search Culture Q. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m., and thank you for listening.